The talk of the town has been transit in Brampton over the last couple of months. Plans for a light rail that would connect Brampton with Mississauga. They were moving ahead with the support of $1.6 billion from Metrolinx and the support of the city of Mississauga. Construction was planned for 2018. Brampton councillors were being asked by the province and local planning staff to confirm their support for the portion of the route that would extend into the heart of Brampton on Huron. It really seemed like a slam dunk, just needing the final blessing from council. But in the summer, people started raising questions, questioning the demand for transit, wondering if bringing transit to downtown would mean losing parking for shops, concerns about the impact of parking on construction, and concerns about a handful of heritage properties that might need to be relocated. They were generating a lot of discussion, and it seemed like what was a slam dunk for the mayor and planners was losing momentum. People were getting bogged down in the myopic details. They were missing out on the bigger picture. In July 2015, council first discussed the decision, when they realized how far they were from consensus on this big decision. More and more pressure was mounting, and councillors who initially supported the extension were actually starting to be influenced by the public opposition. They were considering saying no to $400 million. Instead, they wanted to look at an alternative route that would have no funding commitment from the feds or provincial government.
Finally, the decision came after months of discussion and campaigns from both sides. On October 27th, 2015, 500 citizens attended the council meeting, where councillors heard passionate pleas from the community. The final decision wasn't made until 1:30 a.m.
By voting no, Brampton City Council undermined years of planning and research. Research on the part of staff, from the province, the feds, the cities of Mississauga, and the city of Brampton. And the years of coordination it took to develop a $1.6 billion budget that would allow the construction to start in 2018. They were missing out on a huge opportunity.
How could Brampton Council vote 7-4 against a project with so much potential to transform their declining downtown?
And how can planners help politicians understand why decisions like the Brampton LRT are about so much more than tracks on a street?
Major planning decisions are ultimately made by council, but planners play a key role in guiding those decisions. They provide a professional perspective and analysis to ensure councillors are equipped to make informed choices. Planners have to help councillors connect the dots. Instead of focusing on narrow, short-term thinking, they have to help them understand the broader, longer-term implications of their decisions on the future of the cities they're governing.
We play a very important role in providing due diligence and analysis and recommendations from a professional perspective as to how the city ought to evolve and change and materialize to be in the larger public interest. So there's a very important relationship and dynamic, and at sometimes there's an alignment of interests and at sometimes they're at odds. But at the end of the day, the role of the professional planner is to represent that broader public interest.
I thought that it was over, I could never go on, but you're magic, baby.
So, how can we stop a political implosion like this from happening again? We're going to talk with planners, elected officials, consultants, facilitators, and citizens from across Ontario to understand how planners can communicate better and work within the political arena to shape the cities of the 21st century. In this episode, we explore Planning with Politics, Part 1. I'm Ross Soward.
And I'm Danielle Davis. And this is Cities Alive, bringing the city to life with stories. This is an Ontario Professional Planners Institute podcast. OPPI is the recognized voice of the province's planning profession. Their more than 4,000 members work in government, private practice, universities, and not-for-profit agencies in the fields of urban and rural development, community design, social services, heritage conservation, housing, economic development, and more.
When I arrived in this organization, the city was in probably one of its most bizarre political moments in history, and it's not unreasonable to say that.
Jennifer Kiesmatt is the chief planner at the City of Toronto and a registered professional planner, a position she started in the turbulent Rob Ford years. Regardless of the chaos, she and the other planners at the city hunkered down to navigate the complex departmental and council relationships to get things done. And just like in any relationship, communication is key.
In fact, I believe passionately that it's the obligation of the professional planner to communicate in such a way as to make it clear the implications of decisions, particularly the implications of decisions on our most vulnerable residents, the long-term implications of our decisions, and to link together and to connect a whole series of dots that might not immediately be transparent. So, for example, the importance of linking together, investing in transit infrastructure is a critical part of the long-term sustainability of the city. Making that case and making it clear and explicit is a critical part of city building. Linking together the getting the right densities and the right urban form to ensure that our transit is going to be viable, that's not something that's immediately self-evident either. And we have an obligation to make those connections, to connect those dots, to make it very clear, you know, it's not just about slapping down some transit infrastructure. The way you build the city around that transit infrastructure and the way it connects into the larger infrastructure is a really important part of whether you're creating something that is going to be fiscally sustainable over time, meaning that the operating costs are going to be manageable as opposed to highly subsidized, ensuring that the infrastructure that you're building is going to be well used, those kinds of things. That's the obligation of the professional planner, is to bring that into the conversation in a way that it's meaningful and understandable. And I think ultimately the extent to which we do that will have an implication on whether or not the recommendations we bring forward are understandable. And if they're not understandable, we have to own that. You know, why weren't they understood?
In Toronto, transit planning is an extremely politically charged issue.
Right when I started, there's of course been a long-standing debate going on in this city around transportation projects. What should we build first? What project should happen first? And of course we have a ward-based system, so typically councillors are advocating for transit infrastructure in their ward. But in fact, transit doesn't work that way. For one thing, none of us travel just in our own ward. We need to travel across the entire city. And we know that the success of a transit system in providing lots of choice and lots of accessibility and freedom and access in the city comes back to the extent to which you have a network. So when I began, we launched a project called Feeling Congested that was all about transportation planning in the city. And in the context of that work, we sought to elevate the conversation about the importance of a network and completing the network.
The ability to communicate clearly and explain the relationship between land use and transportation is critical to helping councillors make good, informed city building decisions.
And I would argue that one of the reasons why many of the investments we've made in the past generation haven't had a big impact, because they've just been projects. They haven't been about enhancing the network.
But patience is a virtue, and you don't shift the conversation overnight.
It takes quite a while for those kind of ideas to begin to permeate, particularly when there has been a culture about talking about transit in one way. But we're continuing to do that, and we're seeing shifts. And I'm hearing on the floor of council, councillors talk about a network. And I'm hearing my colleagues at Metrolinx and in other areas talking about a network. And the extent to which we focus on network planning, we're going to get a better transit system.
It's slow, but shaping the narrative around an issue is a powerful tool planners can use to promote a good plan.
Shifting from that paradigm of being project-focused to being network-focused would in fact be transformational for this city.
At the end of the day, it comes back to the idea of negotiating or recommending from a position of strength. And for that, it helps to know where the power lies.
Being able to lead in a complex environment is understanding where your authority comes from and understanding what you're motivated and driven by. And that's why I mentioned the official plan earlier, because the extent to which you can go back to council-approved policy, you're going to succeed in building a great city. So ensuring on the one hand that the city has really good, strong policy, and then using that policy as your authority in those conversations. You know, one of the things we struggle with in this organization, we're sitting in a meeting with staff, and staff from another department, they'll say, yeah, I don't like that idea. To which we go, well, you might not like it, but we actually have a council-directed mandate in the official plan. So whether you like it or not, you know, this happened in a meeting. I'll tell you this story. I won't name names, but we're sitting in a meeting and someone said, well, I don't like street trees. They just die anyway. There's no point in having street trees in the city. So we're not integrating street trees into the streetscape design. You know, to which I said, well, you know, that's interesting that you don't like street trees, but in fact, we have a council mandated direction to be integrating street trees. And it's in our official plan. It's in our policy frameworks. So let's actually figure out how we can make the street trees work.
This idea of connecting the dots and helping elected officials, the public, and other departments understand the bigger picture could really help planners working in an increasingly interdisciplinary world.
Being very narrow and very technical isn't in the interests of the overall city, because the city is diverse, it's broad, it's interdisciplinary, and we need to think in that way if we're going to be successful in implementing outcomes.
Building consensus, drawing more people into the planning process, communicating better, okay. But add in the complexity of people, emotions, politicking, and power, and it's not as easy as it sounds.
One of my first projects was a super controversial project, and I remember being on the job for like 2 months and getting an email from this guy saying, like, you are single-handedly wasting all the only city planning money that is being funneled into our neighborhood that has been for the last 20 years and that will be for the next 20 years. And this is your job to make sure that this is not a total waste of money. And at the rate it's going, like, you're not going to want to put this on your resume, like, no one, like, blah, 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 blah. Like, it was, and I just, like, it was like a punch in the gut. And my initial reaction is to, like, get angry right back, you know. Not, I obviously didn't write anything back or say anything, but my initial reaction was to, I was upset, you know. I was kind of hurt and upset. And it did not put me in a frame of mind to want to, like, help. Not that I would, but it did not make me feel particularly like we're working on this hard thing together. It made me feel like it was on me. And but what I learned and what others taught me was that you need to put your ego aside and listen as hard as you can for the what it is that's motivating the person. What's the thing? What's the constructive piece of advice that they are trying to give you? But that's not coming across as constructive. It's coming across as destructive or insulting or personal. But motivating that is a thing. And whatever that thing is, maybe, like, in all likelihood, has some legitimate thing behind it. So getting over yourself and trying to hear what the thing is that people are trying to say, and that's one of the key things we do in our job, is try to keep conversations constructive. So instead of someone saying, like, the building you're proposing is hideous, we would turn that into, like, advice that we would like the building to be beautiful, for example.
Ian Malcheski is a registered professional planner and facilitator at Swearin Facilitation in Toronto. Facilitators have to look past the emotion of people and politics and frame a conversation so that it's constructive rather than destructive. They call this framing the narrative. Can you clarify?
Yeah, sure. Framing the narrative is a tool that we use to frame a conversation in such a way that the many different perspectives that need to be involved in a conversation can see their perspective in the conversation. And so doing that creates the space for people to potentially find common ground together.
In that way, a good public engagement process is also good risk management. Public engagement can feel slow, costly, and scary because you're opening yourself and a plan up to criticism. It might even get a little chaotic and charged. But Swaran has seen time and time again that if you avoid the tough conversations with the public early, the plan is at risk of being not supported or even actively rejected by the public. Without political or public support and champions, a plan won't get built. A good public process up front will save time and money when you move to adopt or implement the plan. As more and more people demand transparency and to have their voices heard, learning how to frame a conversation with diverse viewpoints to find common ground becomes critical to creating a collective vision with legs. Okay, so that's the theory behind it, but how does this play out in real life?
It is clear to me as a new city councillor that there have been and continue to be enormous development pressures on this urban growth center. However, there has been clearly insufficient both soft and hard infrastructure to keep up with the rapid pace of growth. That's got everything to do with whether it be transit, pipes and wires, school capacity, child care, etc., but also recreation and green space and public realm, both expansion and improvement.
And your name is?
Josh Matlow, Toronto City Councillor for Ward 22, St. Paul's.
Councillor Matlow is talking about the Yonge and Eglinton area in Toronto. It's been designated as one of the five urban growth centres in the city. The project, Midtown in Focus, is a public realm master plan for the neighbourhood. It looks at opportunities to create a network of public spaces to make the area more livable and walkable. But the project exists in a pretty messy political landscape.
Important part of this was that while planning has been happening as best it can, and admittedly imperfectly, in the Yonge and Eglinton area for many years, the Yonge and Eglinton area is separated between three political wards and two planning areas. So on any given month when development, when meetings are happening of community councils to vote on various development applications, if the ones that are south of Eglinton are being considered down at Toronto City Hall, the ones north of Eglinton are being considered up at North York Civic Center at the very same time with different councillors, with different planning staff, and all these decisions are being made in these silos, yet they're often, the sites are often meters away from each other or at least within the same mile. And what happens in one location can have an enormous impact as far as precedent goes on the other sites. So while the first phase of Midtown in Focus was primarily to have a focus on the public realm, both expansion and improvement, it was also an effort to finally, for the first time in history, get city councillors and city staff in both the North York and Toronto East York Community Council planning areas in the same room, at the same table, working with the community on how to plan Yonge and Eglinton.
Juggling different planning area priorities, political priorities, and a very engaged public? Coming from different backgrounds with different goals? Where do you even start?
I don't know if I would say they had different goals, but I would say they had all approached a shared problem in different ways. And that was done in kind of a fragmented way with different, say, residents associations or different business groups lobbying different city planning staff or different councillors about different issues.
Oh, you're back. We seem to be seeing a lot of each other these days.
Everybody was having all these conversations with everybody else, but there was no single forum for people to work together to figure it out. So the counselors created this body called the Midtown Planning Group, which is composed of representatives of the heads of residence associations and the business improvement area, and some people from sports associations and the Toronto District School Board and a housing co-op in the area and many, many others. And that was really the first step, was to get people together to start talking about what are the things that are missing that we need to see.
After the Midtown Planning Group was formed, it was time for people to start getting together to talk.
The atmosphere in that first meeting was, it was collegial, but it was definitely tense because I think people were very ready. You know, it's like if you've been like waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting to have a conversation, by the time you get into the conversation, you're kind of like a little ready to roll.
And these issues are emotional.
Yeah, they're personal. People, it's like they're, it's your neighborhood. And there's, you know, we live in a democracy. And so there's an expectation, and more and more and more in the age of like social media and all that stuff, there is a more and more an expectation that planners or counselors or whoever will listen.
So they started listening, and they didn't just do it once.
Well, we make sure that, so a couple of things, a couple of like just super, I don't know, bit at the highest possible level. We almost never have only one meeting about anything. So one of the things that we always do is meet at least twice, because you got to go, you got to listen, and then you got to come back and you got to show some ideas and say like, did we get it right? You know, like, are we on the right track? How can we fix it to make a little bit better? Because it's very rare, and especially when there is multiple perspectives and controversial things at stake, topics at stake, very rare that you can talk to people once, go away into your cave and come back with the be-all, end-all answer that's going to make everybody happy. So one of the things that we do to create the conditions for people to have an influence is show them that things change based on what they say. So we can go back, do some work, come back, show them what we think makes sense based on what they said, and they could say, yeah, you got this, this, and this right, but you're way off on this, and you didn't even think about this. And so then what we do is everyone will go back and say, okay, check mark on these five things, we did great, but now we need to do something else on this. And then we make the changes. And then ideally you go back a third time and you say, okay, like now we've really like, we think we've got something really good. And at that point, if you've done your job well, and as long as there's no new surprises or things that have come out of the woodwork in the interim, people will nod their heads and they'll say, wow, you listened. And if we didn't, if people suggested something that didn't make it onto the plan or the idea or whatever, you could say, you know, many people asked for this. We did not do it, and here's why.
A lot of good communication comes down to leaving your biases at the door and really listening to what people have to say. In this project, Swerin also used different ways to show people that they were actively listening and that their input was actually affecting the plan.
One of the things that we always do, almost always do, is when we write a summary of a meeting, we'll always share it with the participants in the meeting in draft before we finalize it. And it's kind of in the same spirit of what I said, but we always share it with people in draft to make sure that we accurately articulated their feedback, because that's just another accountability mechanism to show that we're not going to go like quote unquote listen to people and then go do what we want anyway. It's to show like we're actually making an effort here to check in with you at almost every step of the conversation to make sure that you feel your voice has been reflected here. Because there's nothing more frustrating to a person than having someone say they're listening and then twist your words and then walk away with it and say, you said this.
An inclusive process resulted in a comprehensive plan.
I didn't hear any one of the groups from the community who were at the tables say anything other than they were happy with the work that was done. And that's pretty amazing in a highly charged political environment such as Yonge and Eglinton, where there are a lot of pressures and people feeling quite frustrated with the impact of development there.
So the aim was to build consensus, right?
Well, we weren't exactly trying to build consensus, or we were trying to build a certain kind of consensus. In our work, we usually say that consensus means not that everybody agrees with everything, but that everybody can live with the outcome. And they usually are able to live with the outcome because they agree that the process by which you arrived at the outcome was fair and transparent and credible and defensible.
In the Midtown Project, people's fingerprints were all over the final plan. From generally adding more public space to the neighborhood, to tweaking the design of intersections to create a whole series of urban squares along Yonge Street. And that is one of the chief reasons it got so much support from the public, politicians, and planners.
In the Yonge Eglinton plan, we saw people show up, at least a handful of people showed up during the day when city council was meeting to talk to, potentially adopt the plan. And people lined up to say, we really support this plan. We think it's great. More of this, please, because they have other priorities in the neighborhood as well. So, it was a really cool thing to see people come up out to council to say, yes, we support this, especially when we began with a process where people had been, tense and not working together necessarily in a collaborative way. By engaging people, you help build relationships between the city planning division and between residents or businesses or councillors or whoever else is involved. At the end, everybody knows, okay, this is like, given the process that we went through, this is a good plan.
Into the public eye more and more, the politics of planning are becoming more obvious. It's not a matter of trying to react to the political pitfalls.
But instead, planners must become more skillful in their communication, finding ways to frame a city-building narrative that is inclusive to the public and resonates with politicians. It's about finding ways to arrive at common ground. There's an old saying, speak truth to power. In part two of Planning with Politics, we'll learn how Kitchener-Waterloo built the political will for $800 million worth of regional transit investments. You have been listening to Cities Alive, the podcast, bringing the city to life with stories. This episode was created and produced by Danielle Davis, Jordy Gordon, Joel Sajunki, and me, Ross Soward. I hope you enjoyed the awesome music we had in the episode today, and I want to make a point of acknowledging and thanking the great Canadian artists who allowed us to use their great songs. Go online and check out The Modern Men, Golden Youth, and Eloquent. Planning with Politics was an OPPI podcast. For more Cities Alive episodes, subscribe to Cities Alive on iTunes or stream Cities Alive at pdcenter.ca.